Welcome again to the Authors Audio Program, where we interview all kinds of authors from all around the world. I'm your host, Jake D. Steele. You can find us at worldwideweb.authorsaudio.com and listen to any of our author interviews directly from our website. Find them listed under the Featured Author or Archive sections. Today we talk with Ms. Frances Shiny Parker, a writer, consultant, former school principal, and hospice volunteer. Her writing has won awards from Writer's Digest, the Poetry Society of Michigan, the Detroit Writers Guild, Broadside Press, and the New Orleans Public Library. Recently, she has also been honored with the 2007 Service Learning Trailblazer Award, presented by the National Service Learning Partnership. Her new book, Becoming Dead Right, a hospice volunteer in urban nursing homes, is the captivating account of her hospice volunteer experience in Detroit nursing homes. Her personal stories about patients and healthcare familiarize readers with the nursing home world, a world of dementia, pain management, disparities, death, rituals, bereavement, but also the opening of hearts, of great victories and great achievements at the end of hard-won lives. This groundbreaking book, Becoming Dead Right, is published by Loving Healing Press and is now available at her website, also linked through authorsaudio.com, and at amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and other booksellers. And now let's meet Frances Shiny Parker. Frances, how are you today?
Hi, Jay. Good to hear from you, too.
I wanted to start off by telling you, after reading your book, Frances, Becoming Dead Right, how informative your book was to me, and also how sensitively and even poetically it handled this difficult subject for most people, the process of dying.
Thank you.
I want to start here. I'm going to start quoting you immediately. I hope you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Okay. In Chapter 9, you start off in the first paragraph, which I think is a very nice paragraph that sort of describes what we're getting into here, the whole idea of hospices and how they work. And it starts off like this, and I quote, "From Being Dead Right, Frances Shiny Parker, Chapter 9, first paragraph. As sure as rain escorts a hurricane on a turbulent date, cosmic harmony mandates that each person arrive on the other side of through. Death will come, no matter how often the topic is avoided, how forcefully technology wrestles it to the ground, how clearly pleas for more earthly time are heard. People will be confronted with their mortality, whether they like it or not. Those who listen to the universe will be reminded to squeeze out all the pleasure they can in life, to give service to others, and drink blessings with gratitude." And I think you can feel from that small paragraph, it gives the listener a taste of just how thoughtful the writer handles this subject in her book.
Thanks.
And I wanted to start off that with the show with that, because it sets a tone.
Right.
Now, you weren't always a hospice worker. You were actually a former public school principal in Detroit, Michigan. And one day you started taking care of a man you called Jake, and you helped him while he was actually dying with AIDS, I believe. And soon after that, you helped another dying man called Sam. Soon after, you realized you were involved with this very special task to assist people who needed care as they were dying. You took up the hospice volunteer classes, and shortly after that, here you are writing a book about it. So it must have been very inspiring for you, this journey into working in a hospice.
Yes, it really was inspiring, because I really did not start off as a person who really was attracted to helping sick people. But and that was one reason why I was wondering why these people were coming into my life. These two men, this happened over a three-year period, and they were acquaintances. They were not close friends of mine, and they were not close friends of each other. And so after the second man came into my life and also had HIV/AIDS, that's when I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and she said she was a hospice volunteer. I hadn't seen her in a while, and I decided, well, I've really been doing hospice work. I didn't realize it. And that's, so as you said, I took the classes, and and now I've been a hospice volunteer now for 9 years.
For 9 years, yes. I'll just ask you just to hold that phone back just a little more, but we're getting a good sound. What I learned was hospice is a non-aggressive treatment for terminally ill patients, and it also fosters dying a pain-free death. That's sort of the basic tenet of what a hospice is all about. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Uh-huh. How has this focus in hospice work changed your life?
Most people who are in hospice are treated at home. Hospice will actually treat patients wherever they are. And at the end of my class, I had a choice of working in nursing homes or at home, and I decided to work in nursing homes. So just the whole interaction of the nursing home environment, all the people, hospice patients, their families, plus all the people and staff members in the nursing home. I would say just the interactions in general, I think they made me a better person, because I find that people automatically assume my work as a volunteer is very depressing and sad, and it really isn't like that. In fact, there's even research that supports that many hospice patients have a very good sense of humor.
Well, I suppose it's a tough call, and things are up and down every day, but these people don't lose their sense of humor, do they?
No, they don't. And actually, one of the things we do as volunteers is try to make the quality. It's really about improving the quality of life, and the emphasis is on the life part.
Right, the life part, that's the most important. How long have hospices been around, the kind that you're affiliated with now in the United States?
I think it's about 30 years, but actually I'm not sure the exact number of years, but it's much more advanced in Europe. And in America, even, you know, the whole approach to death, still it's far behind in terms of how people respond to death and just view death in general. In America, death is still the elephant in the room that we pretend not to see until it sits in our unfamiliar laps and pokes its intruding trunk in our faces. Many Americans have fears about death, fears about how they will die, what happens after they die, how their lives matter. And because of that, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. We don't have enough death conversations. There are many people actually are terrified of talking about death, particularly their own.
You're right. I think we do live in a society in North America, especially, where we're living in the denial of death. And everything is designed, all the medical treatments and all the advertisings and the drug plans and the drugs, that everything is to put off the fact that one day we're all going to die.
Right, and what happens as a result of that, inevitably it comes and people are not prepared. And that's one of the things I hope the book will help people become more comfortable in viewing death as a normal part of life and preparing for it long before it actually is imminent.
Yes, so I was going to ask you, I know in many areas of the world, hospices are funded by governments or the public purse. I'm just wondering, does Medicare fund this now in the U.S.?
Well, it's funded by Medicare, Medicaid, and also private insurance. But one of the things that, you know, needs to be improved is to the reimbursement of nursing homes and hospice by these funders, because it's still not totally in agreement with the patients' needs, but it is funded. Most of it is funded, but it still needs to be some improvement in that area.
Yes. And you work with a team in your particular environment. You work with a team, a doctor, social worker, nursing assistants, and so on, don't you?
Right, I do. And I want to mention that most people who are referred to hospice die within the first week, and that's because they're referred too late. So that's another concern I have. The average stay in hospice is about a month. This doesn't mean that, you know, people die after a month. In order to get in hospice, a doctor has to put in writing and certify that the person has up to 6 months to live. This doesn't mean they necessarily die. I've had patients live as long, over 2 years, but the majority don't. That's very rare. The average stay is about a month, and its hospice is actually underutilized across the country, and particularly among people of color.
For people who are coming into need of hospice care, how do they affiliate themselves with a hospice or even find a hospice? Do they go through their doctor or someone else?
Well, if first they have to be, terminally ill. Anybody can recommend a patient, so they can just discuss it with their doctor. But the doctor has to certify it in writing for them to become an official patient that they have up to 6 months to live. But anybody can recommend this. And of course, if the patient is already ill, they would have access to the medical health care workers. But what we're finding is that's not happening enough.
Are you referring to contacting someone like yourself?
No, not contacting me, but not certifying them as eligible for hospice with the family. Because by the time I come into the picture, they're already in hospice.
The doctors aren't contacting you enough when people are really in need this way.
Right, and I don't want to just say it's the doctors. Also, many families, there's a sense among some doctors and families that, they failed if the person, is going to be certified as only having up to 6 months to live. And then we have some families, culturally, there may be a distrust of, turning a patient over and actually putting in writing they only have up to 6 months to live, that maybe they might not be, it's just not a good thing in some families. Culturally, some people feel they want to, that it's their responsibility as family members to just take care of the patient and, without having any kind of intervention beyond trying to save their lives. And hospice is non-curative, so this means it's been accepted there's no more cure, and the emphasis is on letting the patient have a dignified death, but also living a high quality of life while they are alive. But there is that realization that death will be coming. It's more conscious once you put it in writing, and some families don't want to admit that either.
Well, what are your duties as an actual hospice worker, Francis?
Okay, well, my duties as a hospice volunteer, as I said, I strictly work in nursing homes. I provide companionship, wheelchair rides. I assist them with everyday concerns. They may have little problems they want me to solve, things that they may need. And also, I'm an advocate for good patient care. So, I evaluate what I see, what's going on. If I think they need help or assistance or something may be neglected, then it's my job to see that I turn to the appropriate people for assistance. Now, all volunteers, hospice volunteers, don't do that. Yeah, there are hospice volunteer jobs that have nothing to do with actual direct patient contact. Some are involved in fundraising. Some do hospice education in the community. Some do office work at the hospice organization. Some bring in therapy pets.
Oh, therapy pets. So that's great.
A lot of people may not be aware. Some people have their pets certified as, healthcare workers as pets. And they go, and there are actually classes that it's mostly dogs, but I have heard of one or two rare cats that also get training so that they can visit patients appropriately. And, of course, even if a dog, isn't trained, this can also be brought up. But, of course, it's never done without the approval of the people at the nursing home. So there are a variety of things that they can do. Hospice volunteers who go into homes would do basically what I do, but they also may, in terms of companionship and, writing letters or whatever they do with the patient, but they also may do small household chores like dusting, washing dishes, laundry, nothing, really major, though. And to provide the caregiver with some relief. Right, and it's called respite care.
Well, I think I'd like to bring it around to the point that after all your experiences as a hospice worker, that you decided you wanted to write a book about it. Now, was that because there just wasn't enough good information out there, or were there other reasons behind that?
Well, that's another thing. Just like I wasn't a person who was looking to work with sick people, I always loved words and writing, but I really hadn't set out to even write a book. after I started doing hospice work, I, you know, just naturally started writing poetry and prose about my experiences. And I shared some of these writings at various poetry readings in, you know, different venues in the Metro Detroit area. And I noticed how people would come up to me after I would read and want to discuss terminally ill loved ones who had impacted their lives even either at that time or maybe in the past. And there seemed to be a need for more caregiver and bereavement assistance. And so then I just, you know, started getting more involved in writing more. And then as I was researching topics that were related to death, I discovered that most books on the market didn't include perspectives of people of color or those dying in urban nursing homes. And I knew from my own experience, and we know in the future, that we have over 70 million baby boomers who are becoming senior citizens. The first wave just made 60. They're dealing with their own elders in terms of end-of-life care, and they're about to deal with themselves in terms of end-of-life care as they get older. So I knew there was a big market out there, and a lot of people don't plan on dying in nursing homes, but that is actually most people, you know, are dying outside of the home in terms of hospitals, nursing homes, or other institutions. So I just thought, well, you know, maybe I would write the book and have a book that would be inclusive of various kinds of diverse populations and also serve as a literal guide for becoming dead right. That's why it's called Becoming Dead Right.
You talk about the importance of rituals in your book and in the dying process. I wonder if you could explain to our listeners a little bit more about that.
Well, actually, right, there are rituals. In fact, I have a whole section in the book on rituals for memorials and also just rituals after death. Even atheists, you know, have something they may even want to do. And now the book covers, you know, a lot on rituals and death. But no, I agree with you. Actually, that's one of the things I'm concerned about in terms of people preparing, so they can prepare their own rituals even before they die. Because I think rituals are important. And I even talk in the book, I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana, and I came to Detroit as an adult, but I can remember even as a child going to wakes, which we now call family hours and all. And I think the ritual aspect is really important in terms of closure for the people who are still alive, who, you know, in terms of their loved ones.
Yes, well, the rituals, that's very true. Rituals are for the people who are still going on and living as much as the person who is passing away or dying.
Right.
Now, you've even got a chapter on rainbow smiles. Now, what exactly are rainbow smiles?
Well, a rainbow smile is a smile that grabs you in a supersized hug and holds you so tightly you can feel ribs of joy press against your essence. And I wrote that section, mainly that chapter, because I wanted people to be aware of the rewards and, you know, how powerful it is doing volunteer work, in particular hospice volunteer work, because it's been a catalyst for many rainbow smiles in my life. I try to balance the book, and I cover dementia, I cover bereavement, death rituals, pain management, racial and ethnic disparities, and caregiving, and of course the nursing home world. But I wanted to make sure that it was emphasized that, you know, there are many rainbow smiles.
Well, I tell you, we'll take all the rainbow smiles we can get over here.
Yeah.
Yes, you mentioned in the book the 10 tips for becoming dead right. Could you go over those for us?
They're very brief, and basically it's just a summary of things that I was, you know, suggesting in terms of becoming dead right. Accept death as part of life. That's the first thing. Listen to the universe. Expect rainbow smiles. Live a healthy lifestyle. Be informed and proactive. Do your best. Give service to others, be grateful for blessings, put death wishes in writing, and have a dignified death journey.
Wonderful. Thank you, Francis. That's great. Thank you.
Thanks.
how should people deal with grief after a loved one has died? Because the grief after someone has died goes on and on sometimes. And how do you treat that?
Well, first of all, people should prepare for death long before they're dying, and make it part of the conversation, part of normal life, and have their wills, their advance directives, and even their rituals in writing. Grief, people have to be patient with themselves and others. Grief is a process. And there's no one way for everybody to experience it. Everybody doesn't go through the same steps. Some people have grief and they need counseling. Others don't. Some people can achieve a kind of healing after a few months. Some people, it may take years. Some people may need professional help. And I'm glad you brought up grief, because so often when we talk about grief, we think about adults. And many times when people die, there are children involved. And
yes.
Children need to be reassured at this time that they are loved, that it's okay to be sad and share their feelings with others. And most of all, they should know that their own responses to death will be taken seriously, because death can be very frightening for children. And, of course, we never tell children that someone went to sleep or tied in with anything like that, because they can begin to fear sleep. But they also need, sometimes we get overwhelmed with adults, rather, with their own grief. They forget that children are experiencing things, and they may not show you this, and this is why it's important for the adults to initiate that reassurance.
Mm-hmm. In the last chapter of your book, Francis, you discussed an imaginary nursing home called Baby Boomer Haven.
Right.
Would you like to explain that a little bit for our listeners?
Right. Sometimes I'll pretend that I didn't say Haven, it's a Baby Boomer Heaven, but it really is Baby Boomer Haven. But for many people, it might be
right.
Heaven. What I did, remember, my background is as an educator, so I'm always in tune with best practices, and there's no point in reinventing the wheel when things are going well already in some areas. So
yes.
Baby Boomer Haven is a nursing home that it's real. For some, on certain levels already, but it's imaginary for too many others. Everything that goes on in this Baby Boomer Haven is already existing in best practices in nursing homes across America, but it's not in most nursing homes. And I'd like to mention the term culture change, because this is a movement that is going on across the country for improving nursing homes and making them more person-centered. A person-centered environment improves the environment for everybody, not just the patients, but also staff members. Some of the things that would be in a person-centered environment would be, first of all, flexible schedules. Everybody may not want to eat at the same time or take a shower or do whatever the schedule. So that would be much more flexible. And in Baby Boomer Haven, they are. And it's an energy-efficient nursing home. It's divided into smaller houses. And it consists of smaller groups of patients that are considered families. And in general, it has a consistent staff, something that I haven't seen a lot of in urban nursing homes. There are resident pets. There are touches of nature indoors. There's a daycare center on the site, so you can have that intergenerational communication going on, which is
I think it's very
and it's becoming more lacking nowadays. Because that also grooms that respect for elders, and also a lot of technological advances. For example, doctors and healthcare workers can keep track of patients, their monitors. It's just a technological, there are a lot of advances that would be in the nursing home. And, of course, most of all, more than anything, everybody has input, and their input is welcome, and there are many activities to keep the residents involved.
Well, some of these things, or maybe most of these things that you've just talked about, cost money, and do you see that in the future that the government in the United States will get much more behind this kind of care?
Yes, I do. And the reason I do is that the baby boomers are gradually becoming the largest population. Eventually, and older people do vote, I know, as you know. So my hope is that as more and more baby boomers, you know, become older and become more aware of these problems, that they will do more, and because of by sheer numbers and the fact that they will be having to experience these nursing homes soon, they will make some changes and that they will get these votes and pressure on policymakers to make some of these changes. And I'm glad you mentioned the part about money, because actually many of the nursing homes that have implemented some of these culture changes really are finding that it really isn't as costly as you might think, because for one thing, once you get a good environment, you don't have that that major turnover where you're always trying to hire somebody because people are leaving because nobody's happy where they are. And when it's broken up into smaller families, houses, it really isn't. In fact, I just visited a nursing home not too long ago that's experiencing this kind of culture change, and they have these smaller houses, and they found that it really isn't as costly or as people had thought it might be.
Well, Francis, I think that your insight into this field and your new book will bring more clarity and understanding to the whole hospice concept, which is, after all, simply people taking care of people. I want to sincerely thank Francis Shani Parker for coming on Authors Audio today to talk about her book and this subject. The book is Being Dead Right, A Hospice Volunteer in Urban Nursing Homes. And I believe the book is coming out in September 2007, correct?
Right, September 1st, 2007. And actually, it can be purchased on the Internet right now at my website, which is francisshawneeparker.com. And I better spell Francis, the whole thing, actually. FrancisShawneeParker. So that's Francis with an E. And then my middle name is Shani, Francis Shani Parker. And it's also at Amazon.com. That's on the Internet.
I want to thank Francis Shani Parker again for coming on our show. And that is the end of the program for today. So this is Jake D. Steele for AuthorsAudio.com saying so long for now and happy reading.